This week on the Union Podcast, Brian Dunning from the Skeptoid Podcast shares tools of skepticism that every fitness freak, geek, and athlete should use when figuring out the best methods to becoming a fitness champion. Any information in this podcast should first be reviewed by the corresponding professional, whether that's medical, financial, or legal, before applying it to your life. The views presented here may or may not be those of the host, guest, Union of Muscle, Black Hat Management, or its affiliates. I just want to give you guys a quick update on the workout routine, doing 100 reps or over 100 reps sometimes on my sets. Body's starting to get used to it, starting to mess around with the diet just a little bit by adding in more fats and different types of vegetables. Oh, by the way, kale smoothie or adding kale into my protein shake first time? Wow, that was a bit rough. Just to let you know, I have done the kale salads before, but it's been a while, so there may be a curve of digestional adjustment that could occur. As of June 1st, no cryptographic currency has taken the lead in its race to greatness. Also, at the end of my update here, I'm going to give you guys a little muscle motivation. This is what I was using. Something I was repeating to myself in my head as I worked out the other day, and it really kept me on point, kept me operating at full force with high intensity. So give it a listen. Muscle motivation. The end has come and gone. Judgment day has passed, and this is how you will spend eternity. The question is no longer how much weight or how many reps? It's when will you break? This is the question that the god or demon who's captured your soul wants to answer. When will you break? So stop thinking about the end of your workout, because there is none. This is how you will spend eternity. Every breath, every rep is meant to glorify your god or piss off your devil. So laugh. That's not pain you feel. That's but an illusion set forth by the being that controls your destiny. So laugh. The pain will not stop you. It doesn't even exist. All that's there is the next rep. If you have to pee, then go pee. If you have to eat, then go eat. But after done, ask yourself, is this you giving up? Is this you giving in? Is that all you are? Is that all you got? There's nothing left? Are you giving up? Get back in there. Lift, run, push, pull. Do not stop, for this is your new eternity. Get it? Welcome to the Union Podcast. I'm Coach Paul. I'm here with Brian Dunning from Skeptoid Podcast. Brian, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Well, hi, thanks. Good to be here. I'm a science writer, and I do a podcast called Skeptoid. It comes out each week. I've been doing it for about 6-7 years now. Yeah, 8 years. And and I take a different topic each week, something that's usually popular in pop culture or pseudoscience, and talk about the real fact, the real history, the real science behind it. It's something that's really educational and fun for me. I think listeners enjoy it too.
Yeah, I've definitely enjoyed your podcast. I've always had a fairly, I wouldn't call it a skeptical eye, but a very examining eye my whole life. I've always asked why, and why is that, and are you sure, is that right? I've always been very questioning of the facts presented to me, and not that I was necessarily skeptical of them, but I wanted to understand why it was what people were telling me the things were. I wanted to understand why. I just didn't, a fact put before me was insufficient for me. I wanted to know more about it and understand why it was. And maybe that's kind of the skeptical eye. I'm not sure if that's the same thing.
It's very much how I think most of us got into it. And when I say most of us, I mean those of us who identify with the whole scientific, skeptical scientific community. It's much the same with me. I was when I was a kid, I was reading all the books on UFOs and Bigfoot and all that stuff. Took every word of it as gospel, believed that it was all absolutely true as written because it was in a book. But it always left me wanting to know more. It's like, well, gee, why hasn't this been on television? Why isn't this a known thing? Why is the author of this book the only person who seems to be aware of these things? And just this great thirst for wanting to know more about how these stories came to be. It's just pretty much how I got to where I am now.
I really like how you talked about when we're young and or even now, sometimes it's especially in the exercise and health industry, books can come out written by just about anybody, and they can have great ideas about what's going to get you fit, what's going to get you thin, what's going to give you the muscles, but that might not be the truth. And you might be asking yourself, wow, this person seems to know something different from everybody else in the world. They must know the secret to fitness.
There's generally an alignment between someone who presents true facts as they're understood by the current state of our knowledge and people who have academic credentials in that field. They're generally along the same path, but not always. You've got people who have proper academic credentials who have completely left the path and are promoting nonsense, and you've got people who are promoting what's the scientific fact. And then on the other side of the fence, you have too. You've got complete non-experts who write books based on total BS and who present very good, well-researched books.
So how...
It's really hard to know, what's right and what's wrong.
How do people figure that out? How is it that, especially our listeners, can, when they hear a claim made or they read a book in the health industry, how is it that they can analyze these things and begin to figure out whether or not what they're reading has any validity?
Well, I think the best answer to that question is going back to Carl Sagan's famous The Skeptic's Toolkit, a list of red flags you can look for, that anyone can look for, whether they're knowledgeable or not in the subject, that'll identify whether this is probably good information, probably bad information.
Right.
And it's important to have kind of a basic fluency with at least the skeptical thought process to consider things like, is this person claiming to be the only person in the world who has discovered this amazing thing? That's really unlikely in every case. Is this person claiming to have overturned all of the experts? That's also really unlikely in every case. Sometimes it's true, but very, very, very rarely. These are kind of red flags that anyone should be able to look for. If it's something like, you turn on the television and, right now, unfortunately, Dr. Oz is America's doctor, virtually everything that guy promotes is complete and utter nonsense. And you can tell that it is because he meets all of these red flags. He's saying things like, here's what your doctor won't tell you, or here's why the pharmaceutical companies are covering this up because they can't profit from it. All of these things that he's saying that have the red flags of being very likely untrue.
Well, that's kind of an interesting example. If people wanted to maybe hone in on an example of someone who's really more about entertaining maybe than about giving you the straight answer, that might be a good example of someone to look at to see what he's doing and how he's doing it, and know that not everything he's presenting is going to be valid as far as getting you the results you're really looking for. I love that episode you did on oil pulling. I've talked to people about that, and I wish I could just get them to listen to your podcast because they don't always believe me, because their friend tried oil pulling and it worked for them. And my response was, are you sure there wasn't anything else that could have been the reason why they got better? Maybe their body finally kicked the bug that was bothering them. Maybe it wasn't the oil pulling. Maybe it was just the natural course of illness where you get sick for a while and you have it long enough and your body takes care of it. I don't know.
You're likely to attribute your getting better to whatever it is that you did
right. The
day before, whether it was oil pulling or putting your shoes on backwards.
Oh, wow. I haven't tried that one. We'll try that next time I'm sick. Put on my shoes on backwards, and hopefully that'll heal me faster.
Oil pulling is another great example of one of these red flags that everyone can look for. to help identify science from pseudoscience. In case anyone listening doesn't know, oil pulling is this process of squishing oil around in your mouth, like vegetable oil, literally squishing it in your mouth. Some people say you should do it for 20 minutes. Some people say you should do it for, you know, a few seconds and spit it out. But they all go back to, they claim that it's based on ancient Ayurvedic technique, this ancient alternative medicine from India. And it turns out that it's not. There is a reference to oil gargling in the Ayurvedic texts, but it's got nothing to do with what people talk about oil pulling today, to health and pulling toxins out of your body. It's this appeal to ancient wisdom. It's based on ancient knowledge from the Ayurvedic texts. That's almost always a red flag, because whether ancient people believed something or not is not how science determines something to be true. Science determines things to be true based on testing results, based on finding out and investigating and experimenting and finding out what works and what doesn't. We don't simply ask, well, did the ancient Chinese believe it or whoever?
Right.
Anytime you see the appeal to antiquity, the appeal to ancient knowledge as the explanation for why something works, that should always be a big red flag.
Right, and then there was that 2012 calendar that the Mayans or the Aztecs had that people decided predicted the end of the world, and then the joke was, well, if they were so good at predicting the end of the world, how couldn't they predict the end of their own civilization?
You know, and what's interesting is the Maya never did disappear. Maya still lives.
Oh, that's true.
Today.
That's true.
They never did disappear, and they were, through that whole 2012 craze, the Mayans were up on their ears saying, this is BS, we had never said anything like this. Stop attributing this to us, because it's not true. But nobody wanted to listen to that, because it wasn't the sensational explanation that everyone wants. Everyone wants to know the amazing, sensational thing.
What about the placebo effect, which seems to be effective, as well as willpower in the gym?
You know, there's this mind over matter that when I'm in the gym or when someone's in the gym, you almost have to employ in order to get yourself to push through the next rep, to lift the next heavier weight. And sometimes that almost goes in contradictory of being skeptical, because if you're skeptical, you say, well, can I really lift that weight? Can I really do that? But we do this employing of kind of this faith, this idea that, you know, sometimes whether or not you believe in something, you take that chance that you're going to be able to push up that extra rep, that you're going to be able to do another pound of weight, that you're going to be able to push. And then when we talk to people, or when I've talked to people who are believing in some of these things they should be more skeptical about, they can attribute it back to that placebo effect. Well, if it works for them, why am I going to argue with them that what they're doing is not valid or wrong? How do we understand these two dichotomies when in life?
I'm not sure what you're asking. You're talking about the placebo effect is obviously very real.
Right.
And it can help you, overcome certain symptoms, can relieve things like nausea, things that exist only in your head, things that are your brain's response. It can address pain. It can address insomnia, things that are responses by your brain to a condition. But the placebo effect can't treat the condition. Let's say you've got a knee injury and you try acupuncture. Acupuncture can, in many cases, help with the pain, but it can't help the knee injury heal. All sorts of alternative medicines can be used for things like cancer, and they cannot actually improve the cancer, but they can, in many cases, improve your perception of your symptoms, and they can provide what we call a palliative response. It can help you deal with the pain or feel better about it, but it's not going to actually cure the illness. You know, you're talking also about like going to the gym and saying I get myself psyched up enough,
right,
I can push an extra pound. Well, yeah, that's not really even the placebo effect. That's simply the effect of getting yourself psyched up and getting more adrenaline flowing through your system and being able to, you know, max out. That's a real thing too. That's what's that called? That's the acute. Well, we typically call it the fight or flight syndrome.
Right.
But it has a real medical name too. Acute something response, and I'm not remembering it. But I did a great episode on that. Really fascinating stuff. Your body can strengthen itself to a limited degree in times of great need. That's why we see records broken in the Olympics more than in other competitions, because there's more pressure on the athletes. They're literally more pumped up psychologically, and they literally can perform better.
I think I remember that episode. You talked a little bit about people, these rumors of people having strength to lift cars and things of that nature. Is that the one you're referring to? Yeah. That was
exactly,
a good one.
Exactly, yeah. And you know, there's a tiny amount of truth to that, but no way could it ever give someone strength to lift a car, for example. I mean, the body's physiological structure would break. It can't improve the strength of tendons and bones and things like that.
So you're saying that even when this idea of faith or placebo effect or this mental overcoming of current ideas, that there's still a scientific explanation for how that actually works.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's fully understood.
Okay.
There's a lot about the placebo effect it's a very active area of research. We don't understand everything about it, but we do have sufficient observational studies to know that it is very real. People often accuse science of claiming to know all the answers for everything, which is so fundamentally silly, because why would scientists have jobs if we already know all the answers? Scientists exist to find answers that we don't know. So telling a scientist that he claims to know all the answers is like telling a pilot that he can magically imagine himself any place he wants to be without having to fly his plane to get there. He's a pilot because he needs to be able to get there.
Right. I had someone in the gym the other day ask me, why do some guys who are doing the deadlift take off their shoes? I said, well, I'm not really sure why they do it. I've never done it. And he says, well, I thought you were kind of an expert in fitness. And I said, well, yeah, but that doesn't mean I know why everybody does what they do. You know, and I said, there seemed to be a correlation between the shoeless deadlift guys and the advent of that new shoe with the five-finger toes. So I don't know if there was just a lot of propaganda going around that. I haven't studied why people are actually doing that or whether taking off your shoes actually does help you do deadlifts any better or any worse than if you were wearing shoes. I have this feeling that it doesn't matter too much. That might just be a mental thing. If you find that you can lift better without your shoes on, maybe that's true for you because you've decided that yourself. Maybe it's a mental thing that you've decided yourself, but I don't think there's anything else besides that backing it up. Is that the right way to look at these claims?
Yeah, I think so. I would agree with you completely, even though I'm not a fitness expert. I have no idea. I don't know anything about deadlifting techniques or what's a good thing to do or what's a bad thing to do, but I do very much know that different athletes have different styles for everything. If you compare runners, you know, their gaits are all a little bit different. Everyone plants their foot a little bit differently. And when this whole barefoot running fad came big a few years ago, and we had the Vibram Five Fingers and a whole bunch of other kind of copycat products, they were all trying to capitalize on this barefoot running fad.
Right.
We did finally get some good science on this. And what we did find out was that it doesn't matter. If people who have been accustomed to running barefoot, if they switch to shoes, they will undergo a period of pain and injury as their muscles and feet adjust, and then they'll be fine. Vice versa, if you've been accustomed to running with shoes and you switch to barefoot, you too will probably go through a period of adjustment and some pain and stuff, and then you'll be fine. You could do either one. There's no clear advantage of one over the other. It's really interesting learning some of the things that we discovered through that is one of the basic claims of the Vibram Five Fingers, and which is the reason why they just had the class action settlement, was because this claim was proven to be false.
Oh, wow.
Because Vibram was saying, this will make your feet stronger. Because it sounds intuitive, it sounds, well, you know, shoes are supporting your foot, they're making your, relieving your feet of having to use their muscles. Switching to barefoot makes your muscles start to do what they were intended to do. And it turns out that that's not false. In fact, it might even actually be a little bit of the opposite. Because if you think of the height, when you're wearing a shoe, add some height to your heel, right? Your heel is now, three quarters of an inch, whatever, higher off the ground. That actually increases the leverage angle side to side. And some of your muscles need to be stronger to stay straight with that increased leverage angle.
Okay.
So there's all sorts of interesting subtleties that had never really been thoroughly studied until that fact came out. It was very interesting.
I think I saw one. I believe there was an episode of Nova Science where the the host and they put him on a treadmill to study how the force of the impact of his heel as he hit the ground. And so they did one where he just ran as he normally runs. And they said, okay, this time I want you to concentrate on really putting a lot of pressure through your heel and really trying to slam down with your heel harder on this treadmill. And we're going to see that your speed actually increases when you do lead with your heel. And this, of course, is going against what a lot of these five-finger toe people are saying. They're running on their toes. And so they did the experiment where, you know, he ran regular, and then when he really tried to land on his heel and push through his heel and get a lot of force through the ground, his speed increased without that much more effort. He wasn't any more winded or tired than before, but he just making sure that he planted his heel and pushed through it. And they said, that's why you want to have strong muscular legs as a runner, because the more you can push off the ground, the more momentum you're going to get in pushing yourself forward.
Interesting. Before the whole barefoot running fad, there was one early study that had received some significant amount of attention, which still wasn't a lot, but it was a little bit, where they had filmed in slow motion, filming the foot strike of people who ran with shoes and people who ran barefoot.
Uh-huh.
For example, they went somewhere, I don't know where it was, but somewhere like Africa, where people typically didn't wear shoes. And they filmed their foot, and they found, oh, people who weren't run without shoes, they strike with the front of their foot more, and people with shoes strike on the heel more. So If we can all learn to run barefoot, it's going to give less wear and tear on our heels, because we're going to hit our heels not so hard. And that turned out to be something that was not reproduced. When the study was repeated by other people in larger scales, they simply found that everyone runs differently, whether they wear shoes or not. Some people tend to be heel strikers, some people don't. It's got nothing to do with whether you're used to running with shoes or without. That was a case of a very small sample size being promoted by the press as if it was an answer, and it wasn't. It was really just a pilot study, and when a pilot study shows good results, then it means we should expand it to a broader scope and bring in a lot more study participants and control it better. And that's what we found out, is that it doesn't make any difference whether you strike your heel or the front of your foot.
No. I think that Nova episode that I saw, they were doing the studies on running, and they were saying that for the majority of people, that if you can learn to strike with the heel first and press through, you're going to be able to increase your speed.
Can there be any valid claims about increasing human performance? Or is it because that everyone is so different that there's no possible way that one method can help the majority of people? Should we not trust any claim about increasing performance?
I wouldn't say so. Now, I haven't seen the episode you're talking about,
right,
and I'm not familiar with whatever was concluded, so I can't speak to that.
But right.
Just from general knowledge, I know that swim coaches teach a very particular stroke for people to swim faster,
right,
to break records. And nevertheless, we have outliers like Janet Evans, the American gold medalist, who had a very bizarre swimming stroke that made no sense at all. So even though we can find out what techniques may generally work well for most athletes, there's always going to be people who have just a large variation, and different strokes work for different folks, quite literally and figuratively.
So you're saying then we can generally find optimal ways that the average, that the mean's going to be able to find ways to improve.
And to achieve
higher areas of human performance. I mean, I think your example of the Olympics is good, because the Olympics shows us that there are ways that we can continually push the boundary of the human capabilities, in at least in that area of sports. And I don't know if we can make any type of claims as far as mentally goes, because there aren't that many mental decathlons that you can get involved in that I'm aware of. But in sports, at least, we can see that we've been able to keep pushing these boundaries of human performance in the Olympics. And some of that's done through technology. They're finding new swimsuits that they can wear. They're finding different types of training methods where they're going up to high altitudes. But for the average person, there's a lot out there that claim supplement X is going to push you over to the next level. Okay. Are there any supplements out there that you know of that are good? This may be totally out of your area of expertise, but really, what can somebody look for as far as claims go on products that claim this or that?
I've done a lot of work on this.
Oh, okay.
And in my experience, virtually every supplement product claiming to improve your athletic performances is bogus. That is, if you want to improve your performance, then yes, you do need to generally eat well and exercise, make sure you're getting a good diet, but you need to also work with a coach and work on your technique rather than buy some product that says this is going to work for everyone and this improve. I mean, it's silly. It would be a banned substance if it actually improved performance. That right there should be a tip-off that it doesn't do anything. Anything that claims to be a supplement, I know there's a lot of protein supplements. I did an episode a few months ago where I had half a dozen questions sent in by students that were all pretty much about miracle diets and miracle diet products, miracle supplement products. They're asking this or that. When you read the research articles that have been done on all of these, the ones done by the company selling the products, but the ones that actually end up getting published in journals, you can see that there's just no reason to take these. Anything that's in a supplement product is already in your regular diet to the amount that your body is going to use it. Now, there's exceptions. If you're bodybuilding, you need to eat a lot of food.
Right.
You need to get a lot of calories. You need to get a lot of protein. You need to eat basically more than your body is going to use. You need to overflow that bucket so that as your body's building muscle, it's always got whatever it needs in the bloodstream to take from. That's bodybuilding. That's kind of an exception. That's when you're actually trying to build muscle. The rest of the time, if you're just trying to be healthy or maintain optimum status, any diet, anything remotely like a regular diet in the Western world contains more than enough of the nutrients, all the vitamins and minerals that anyone reasonably needs on a regular basis. This is something that the supplement people will argue to death. You got to remember, their business is selling miracle products. Buy this, you will achieve super health or super fitness. Therefore, they will vehemently argue against all the scientific studies that say, you just don't need this. Your human body has evolved over millions of years to make use of the food that you put into it. Human bodies use the food you put into it. They never needed miracle supplements before, and that's why we don't need them now.
You said eating the Western diet is good enough, but are we not experiencing an obesity epidemic, or is that just hype as well?
I didn't say a Western diet. I meant anything like a diet in, I may have said anything like the Western world. I meant not starving to death in Africa.
Oh,
if you're eating anything like a diet that's not starving to death, you're going to be fine. Obesity, that's overeating. That's overeating and under-exercising. Obesity is not malnutrition. If you're eating 5 cheeseburgers a day, yeah, you're going to get fat, but you've also got all the nutrients, vitamins, and minerals your body needs. I mean, you could do that and be a bodybuilder.
There are bodybuilders who do eat the cheeseburgers and everything else on their bulking phases, and then they have to sweat everything off later on, so to speak, when they're trying to get down to a lower body fat for their competitions. They'll then try to lower their calorie intake and increase their cardio. I try to take a very balanced approach because I'm not trying to bulk up quickly. I'm not a fan of bulking up quickly. I think you can end up overeating very easily if you're going about trying to put on the bulk. You can overeat. It's very easy, and then you end up putting on a lot of fat that then you have to go work off. I recommend that people take a more balanced approach, that you kind of learn your area of how much you need to eat in order to gain weight, how much you need to eat in order to lose weight. And there are tons of studies out there as to, you can go online. The Mayo Clinic has a calculator that you can plug in your numbers and it'll spit out how many calories you should be eating based on your exercise level. And that's a fairly good place to start. Now, of course, everyone has their allergies and things that they like to eat, things that they don't like to eat. And you can kind of tweak it from there. That's a healthier approach, even for those who are trying to build muscle. The interesting thing about bodybuilding is that if they're really wanting to make a career out of it, they're going to probably end up experimenting with certain banned substances. And for me, I think you really have to weigh out the risk versus the reward on whether or not you're going to make the kind of money you need to in order to justify the kind of possible negative effects that you're going to get from those banned substances.
That's certainly true. That's outside of my experience, but I find that very interesting. First, the idea that there are professional bodybuilders who make a living from it. I didn't know that.
So we've talked about this in a few episodes. There's this idea in the fitness community that if you work out hard and you get up on a competition stage for bodybuilding and you get your pro card, that now you're going to be set for life, that the supplement companies are just going to come rushing at you with endorsements here and endorsements there. But that's not actually how it works. In fact, most of the people who are successful or who are perceived to be successful in bodybuilding are people who have taken a course closer to what Arnold did. He used bodybuilding, not that he made money right off the bodybuilding itself. He probably did get into some supplement endorsements, but then he invested in real estate. Then he got into the movies. Then he got into government. He became a businessman, and he used bodybuilding as a way to open up doors for him in other areas. And those are the people who are still successful today in bodybuilding are those who have got these great physiques. They've gotten up on stage. They've won the prize money. There is prize money that you can win. And for the Arnold and the biggest competitions, those prizes are quite high. But you're competing. That's why the competition's so stiff. And that's why there's so much drug abuse up on those higher levels, is because that prize is very high. And not everybody's going to win. And so even if you win that amount of money, there's a good chance you've already spent that amount of money. This is what happens in competitions very often, is that you're most likely going to spend, if you're smart, you're probably spending pretty close to where that prize money is. Because if you win, your investment pays off. But where if you don't, the investment doesn't pay off. And this is
like the XPRIZE, where they're looking to develop different technologies,
is that they can get more people to spend more money, because they'll spend right up to the amount that they need to in order to beat the next guy above them. And sometimes they'll spend over that amount because they'd rather lose a little bit of money than a lot more money. And if they can win by spending over the amount that the prize money is, just to make sure that they're lowering their losses, sometimes they'll do that too, so they can get a lot more money spent that way. And this is what's going on with the supplement companies. This is what some people don't understand, is when they get into the fitness industry, the supplement companies understand this. They're the ones who love these bodybuilding competitions just as well. I mean, I like them too. I think it's great to show off all the hard work people have been putting in. But that's the idea. They want you to spend all that money that you expect to win or could win on all the supplements, and even maybe even a little bit more, just so that way you can beat the next guy, so you're lowering your losses. And over that whole spectrum, everybody who's up on stage is spending that money on the supplements to get the peak results.
Yeah. Well, if you have a large segment of your audience that is into bodybuilding and fitness, then I'd probably upset a lot of them by saying that supplement products are worthless. And certainly, science writers are not the friends of supplement manufacturers, in any case. By no means am I the only one. It's pretty universal. What I would suggest, it is really super, super easy to go on the internet and find information supporting any supplement claim you want.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of money in it, and they're writing the articles, and they're having, doing their own little studies, whatever. It's super easy to find the information that supports your preferred conclusion, which is that this is a miracle product that will buff you up if you buy it. But if you're responsible, then you should also search for the opposite. So an easy way to do that is to add the term skeptic to your search term in Google. So name a supplement product for me, a type of.
I take Bulnox. I'm a big fan of Bulnox. It's got some caffeine in there. It's got some nitric oxides in there. And I find that
is that a brand name or
Bulnox is a brand name.
Okay, give me something that's not a brand name. Like, what class of supplement would you call that?
That's
protein supplement?
No, that's a pre-workout.
Okay, I would just go and say pre-workout supplements. Do a Google search.
Okay.
Do another Google search with pre-workout supplement skeptic.
Okay.
And you will almost certainly find that there's a medical website or something that is trying desperately to protect from being ripped off by worthless products, almost always in a failing manner. But people should try and find information that does not support their preferred conclusion if they want their, if they indeed want to know what's actually likely true.
Right, and I think there's a certain responsibility that anybody who puts themselves out there as a fitness expert or in any other field, you should maybe be responsible about the information that you're giving out, and that if you find out that the information you have been giving out is wrong, you should probably try to retract it. I know you do episodes where you retract on mistakes you've made, and your attitude is fantastic, exactly how your attitude should be. It's just, we're all human, we make mistakes, let's not build our identity around claims that we make when we're all prone to mistakes, and we're all prone to reading information that might be erroneous, as we might find out later on. It's not, we can't personalize these facts that we spit out as a part of our identity. And I think that's what happens a lot in the fitness industry, is that people begin to tie their identities to the supplements that they take, the supplements that they sell, and then it's very hard for them to research and to disavow this information because it's become a part of their identity. And that's going to be a hard pill to swallow.
I mean, it's part of my advantage in not being into bodybuilding or any of that stuff. I don't have any vested interest either way. It's quite easy for me to go out and find out what's going on. So that's the deal. This stuff is all BS. If I was someone who'd spent a lot of money and was very financially and emotionally and psychologically invested in this idea, it would be much harder to go out and change my mind so easily based on what I can learn. There's a great example who's really popular right now, and that's the Food Babe. I only heard about the Food Babe last week or so, but it's apparently some girl who's phenomenally successful with her Twitter account and her Facebook and her blog. And basically she just promotes whatever the worst, stupidest food fad of the week is what she promotes and blogs about. As a result, she's been all over television. And it's interesting to notice that she's getting really closely associated with the conspiracy theory websites like Alex Jones and InfoWars and Natural News, all these websites that are all promoting the idea that, you know, everything is a conspiracy. All the food companies are conspiring to make you sick, and the pharmaceutical companies are all conspiring to make you take drugs.
But not the supplement companies?
But not the supplement companies, though. They give their products away for free, of course, don't they? They must, sure. It's very interesting to see how quickly any argument in favor of a natural cure or something that's non-pharmaceutical or something that goes against established science. It's funny to see how quickly that turns into a conspiracy theory argument.
Right.
The scientists are conspiring with the pharmaceutical companies to hide this natural miracle supplement from us.
Yeah, it's hard for me to demonize doctors and everyone else who's been educated, because I've gotten educated too. And I have friends who are doctors and health professionals and who work for the pharmaceutical companies. And I haven't met one of them yet that's diabolical. Not one of these people that I personally know who is in this industry is a diabolical person who's seeking out the destruction of everyone around them. In fact, most of them are pretty good people. Some of them wanted to be oncologists and try to cure people of cancer. You know, others, most of them have pretty altruistic emotions when they go into the healthcare industries. And I guess everyone assumes that their medical school has made them take an oath to only say one thing and do another. I think we do know that their time is, it's difficult for doctors to take the time on every patient as they would like to. And sometimes because of the high quantity of people they have to see, it can be easy for them not to notice everything that's going on with everyone. And I think that's where people do need to take an interest in their own health and do need to know what's going on with them and take account of what's going on. I'm fine with people doing the cold quantified self approach, where they begin to take data of what's going on with them and let their doctor know. do some of the data, do some of the research for yourself, and come in and ask questions. And the doctor's offices, if you sit down there in the doctor's office, sometimes they've got little TVs on that say the exact same thing. They say, hey, research out your questions. Come in with a list of questions for your doctor. And he's happy to answer them. If you're not invested in your health, if you're not wanting to ask those questions, he can't magically come up with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. That's true. I hear a lot the idea that doctors don't have time to spend with patients. Therefore, you should go to a naturopath, chiropractor, nutritionist, et cetera, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
But I say, boy, I don't know what's wrong with your, go to a different doctor.
Right, right.
My doctor's great. I've never had that issue with my doctor. My doctor's awesome.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Switch to a better doctor.
That's true. Yeah.
Don't reject science. Switch to a doctor who has more time.
That's true. Yeah, and, I've been to a chiropractor too, and as soon as they're done with that first consult where they tell you that what they're doing is not a placebo and that it's real, then your visits go down to fairly close to maybe 5 minutes if you're lucky. They get down this one pattern of adjusting people and then, crack, 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 you're out the door. I don't know how much more time you're getting with them. And once they got you in the door, sorry, chiropractors. I know there's some chiropractors listen to the show. I'm not trying to down what you're doing or anything. I've found that for me, anything I get out of a chiropractor, I can get out of yoga. If I go to a yoga class, I'll get the same type of stretching, the same type of popping that I want to, and the same type of pain relief that I can get from a chiropractor doing yoga. And most chiropractors are going to agree with me that if you're doing yoga, your need, so to speak, for chiropractic care is far less likely because you're already doing things to keep that spine in alignment, as they would tout.
As they would tell, yes. Chiropractic is interesting because it has evolved a lot in probably just the last 20 years. Because 20 years ago, chiropractors were still giving the full-on magical energy healing explanation for what chiropractic is and why it works. And today, most of them are basically just unlicensed physical therapists. They're giving conventional physical therapy, which is massage. They combine it with the movements that make the knuckle cracking sound in your spine, which, of course, by itself has no clinical benefit of any type. It's really just stretching the muscle.
Right.
Massaging, stretching the muscle, doing basic physical therapy stuff.
Right.
And that's what chiropractors are doing. They're calling it chiropractic. It's not. I wish they wouldn't do that. I wish they would go out and actually get their physical therapy licenses so they could do it legally and call it what it actually is. But I think you see a lot more of the straight-up magical-based explanations that chiropractic is truly founded upon.
I've heard that a lot of them do go to certain chiropractic schools or...
They have their own schools. They have their own self-certification board. They
right.
have their own chiropractic schools are... accredited by, they even come up with their own accreditation board so they can accredit themselves
right.
and have their own schools and call themselves doctors. And I think in every U.S. state now, I think you can actually, calling yourself a doctor of chiropractic is actually a protected term. You can't say that you're a doctor of chiropractic unless you've actually gone through one of these accredited programs at a school. That's unusual among alternative medicine. Nutritionists, for example, anyone can say that you're a nutritionist.
Right.
It doesn't mean anything at all. It's not a dietitian.
Right.
You can't call yourself a dietitian.
You have to look at the state laws, I think, where you're at, and different states have different rules as far as when you can and you can't call yourself certain terms. Now, they don't get into details of how you got that proof or how you got that certification. There just needs to be one. So I think that's also fairly interesting, is that there are rules that kind of almost create an industry, and which is great for creating jobs and things of that nature, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting any level higher of care or professionalism by that person having that certain certification. In fact,
there's a lot of ethical problems with that too, because in the states where you're seeing boards being created for alternative medicine practices, who do those boards consist of? Well, obviously they consist of generally the leading professionals in that profession in the state. And they're doing it basically to protect their profession.
Right.
To make their profession look legitimate and to incentivize competition so that anyone can't just hang out a shingle and say, I'm a nutritionist.
Well, I mean, you
go through and pay them and join their board, and which they have control over.
The same thing could be said about lawyers and doctors.
Well, no, the same thing can't be said about doctors because...
Oh, but just lawyers.
they actually have to go to schools that are accredited.
Right.
There are actually, what's the government board that accredits accreditation? AMA certified medical professions, for example. You can say that I'm a cardiologist.
Right.
And you know that that's a real thing, and he actually had to go to a medical school that's accredited for real, and that accreditation board is recognized by the government. Same with lawyers, same with doctors, but not the same for chiropractors or for any sort of alternative medicine. Those are not AMA recognized. They had to self-accredit. They created their own accreditation boards to accredit their own colleges. It's completely a private enterprise.
Well, doesn't that...
But they've been successful enough bureaucratically
right.
to get laws to prevent people, any Joe Blow, from saying, hi, I'm a doctor of chiropractic.
Right. Doesn't that kind of play into a little bit of this conspiracy theory, though, for those who want to say that the government is then in league with all these doctors and the lawyers and everybody else, and it's a big conspiracy?
That is absolutely one of the first arguments that I get every single time. Conspiracy theory, conspiracy, conspiracy. It's all a conspiracy.
Yes, and you know, I do some interpreting in the courts for those who can't speak English very well, and that's one reason why I have a hard time believing that the government is just trying to abuse and take advantage of people. Because if that were the case, why would I have that little side job? Why would they even bother allowing somebody to understand what's going on in the courtroom when they get that traffic ticket or whatever else it is? Even for traffic tickets, they'll invite me into the courtroom to interpret for that person. And I don't know how many other countries do that. It's just very opposite of what I would think a conspiratorial maleficent government would be doing, is giving people aid.
Yeah, it's such a difficult question because government obviously is not a single monolithic entity.
Right.
It consists of millions of individuals, all of whom have their own set of ethics and values and
yes.
everything. And you know, there is corruption in government. Corrupt government is not perfect,
right.
obviously.
Right.
And the government-certified accreditation boards are not perfect,
sure.
obviously. But it is the system that we've come up with that's about as good as we've been able to put together, and we continue to improve it when and as we can. But it's not... The first thing I always get accused of whenever I poke fun about the people claiming conspiracy theory is they'll accuse me of saying, you're saying government is perfect. It always loves us and wants to protect us. No, actually, I didn't use any words about that concept whatsoever. The people who really want their conspiracy theories to be true, that's just their straw man argument against the argument against their conspiracy theories. Anyone who disagrees with me thinks government is perfect and loves us. Well, no, that's not true.
I think it's a lot of fun to be able to look at life slightly skeptically. And to take a look at, you know, whether it's a claim somebody's made on TV. I don't know why people believe anything they see on TV or even on the internet. You gotta take things skeptically. And I think that's one reason why I like your podcast so much, is because you are making that attempt. You are making that attempt to give people tools that they can use to begin to analyze the situations in life. So maybe you can't give them all the knowledge, but you can give them tools of skepticism, so to speak, to allow them to analyze situations more fully. The first reason I invited you on this podcast was because I had a lot of friends who were getting involved in these MLMs, the multi-level marketing schemes, the network marketing schemes. I've talked about them on this podcast a few times already, calling them bottom-up wealth redistribution scheme. And I know you had an episode talking about that as well. And I think your advice was to tell them to stop. Just stop right now. But that doesn't always work.
They're not likely to do it. But the longer you stay in it, the more money you're going to lose. You've got to cut your losses at some point. It might as well be sooner rather than later.
Yeah, well, I've found that even some of these ones that are around here in the Roanoke Valley in Virginia have a lot of claims that they're actually able to back up a little bit because they're not taking the money out of their downline that quickly. They're allowing the downline to use that money to bring in other people and to build up their distribution channel. So they're not sucking the money out of them that quickly. And so they are having a few months of prosperity where they have all this money that they that have. And yeah, I guess if they got out then, they might be ahead of the game. But it's a lot like Vegas.
I assure you that those people had to first make some purchases of some product.
Oh, yeah.
If they weren't given all of it, okay, then they've lost money. You can't look at just the plus column and ignore the minus column.
Oh, yes, definitely.
You were sold a product at a ridiculously overpriced,
mm-hmm.
and then now you're told to go out and try and sell people, and maybe you make some sort of a commission that's deducted from, maybe you get a credit against your next purchase. You cannot ever just look at the minus column, or just look at the pluses without the minuses.
Well,
if distributors actually made money off the companies wouldn't exist. They can't exist by losing money.
Say that again.
The multi-level company right. would not exist if they were paying their people more than they were making.
Oh, of course not, but no company would exist if they were paying their people more than what they were making.
Yeah. Why would it be any different? Everyone says that their multi-level marketing program is different. This one's better. This one works. The model is tweaked in such a way so that they all say that. And it's never true with any of them.
I think the biggest problem is that the wealth that is coming to the upline or the people above you is from you and all your family and friends. So there are people who can make money at these, but they're doing at the expense of you and everyone else that you know. And you're leveraging, they ask you to go out and leverage your relationships for money. So they say, well, if these people really cared about you, they would invest whether or not they believe it or not because they care about you. And so you're putting a price tag on the value of your relationships, and you may go up to them and say, you know, well, if you really cared about me, you'd spend X amount of money on me. And so now you've put a dollar value on that relationship. I don't think that's a good thing to do. I don't think that's going to help you have good relationships with other people. And oftentimes that's the cost of these multi-level marketing schemes are more than just that dollar amount. It comes at the price of relationships that you've built over years.
Generally, every time, I can smell it coming a mile away. It's happened to me so many times. But when a friend comes, you know, you haven't heard from this friend for a couple of years, and suddenly they want to meet for dinner, you can just hear it. I'm going to pitch you a multi-level marketing program.
Yeah.
You can just hear it between the lines. And you're absolutely right. You very quickly go through all your family and friends. You piss them all off.
Right.
And that's definitely a cost for them. Let me give you my favorite factoid.
Okay, great.
Multi-level marketing.
Great.
99.95% of network marketers lose money. 99.95. So when you're talking about these few people at the top that actually do make money, that's 0.05%.
Right.
5% of 1%. And that's generally the founders themselves.
Right.
Their brother or whatever.
Right.
However, 97.14% of roulette players lose money. So you're actually 250 times more likely to make money playing roulette than participating in any network marketing program, multi-level marketing, whatever term you prefer.
Right.
So instead of buying the miracle juice or whatever it is, go to Vegas, play roulette, you're 250 times more likely to win.
And it sounds like a lot more fun. And you don't have to stretch it out over such a long period of time. You can lose all your money a lot more quickly and probably enjoy it.
Any of your friends.
Right. Unless you borrowed their money to go do it. Well, Brian, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast. And hopefully we've given some people some tools that they can use to look at health and supplements a bit more skeptically. So that way they can get the best benefit and spend their time, energy, and money on those things that are actually going to get them results, like food and exercise.
I hope so. But just as much, I hope that they will become infected with the joy of discovery as I have. Any time I'm researching any topic, whether it's something that's, hard science like supplements or whether it's a historical mystery, it's when you take the extra trouble to dig deeper, go past the marketing, go past the television shows, find out what was really happening. Take the trouble. It's so worth it. single time, finding out what's real is always more exciting than finding out what's popular in the news at the time. I just couldn't love what I do more.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Union Podcast. Please stay tuned for a message from the Union. Okay, all you beautiful fitness freaks, geeks, and athletes, don't forget to like us on Facebook, subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, sign up for free membership in the Union of Muscle, help our union-sponsored athletes by donating to their fund, and lift strong and prosper. Congratulations, all you fitness freaks, geeks, and athletes. By listening to this entire podcast, you get a union membership free. Simply go to www.unionofmuscle.com and click on the union membership registration form. Now, as a member of the Union of Muscle, you get updates on this podcast, as well as the ability to earn points for staying fit. I call these points Fitcoin. You can earn Fitcoin by tracking your fitness, getting fitness certifications, participating in team events, or going on union raids, and so much more. Track your success on the Union Leaderboard, where you can compete with other union members, athletes, for top placement in a fearsome competition of fitness. Do you want to become a fitness freak, geek, or athlete? Go to unionofmuscle.com and subscribe as an athlete. It's only $15 a month, and that gets you access to your own fitness counselor to give you diet plans, workout routines, and more. Would you like to be a guest on our podcast? Go to theunionofmuscle.com and go to the Contact Us page. There you will find an application for guest speakers. Do you compete in bodybuilding physique or bikini and are not yet sponsored? The Union of Muscle can help with our union-sponsored competitor fund. Join other highly effective value-building competitors and share in the success. Go to www.unionofmuscle.com and click on the union-sponsored competitor tab. For more information, join the union. Do you have a great idea for a podcast or think you can do a fitness podcast better? Go to www.fullservicepodcasts.com. That's podcasts with an S. Get as much or as little help as you need creating and hosting podcasts on iTunes and on the internet. That's www.fullservicepodcasts.com. Podcasts with an S.com. The race is on. Are you a fan of cryptographic currencies? Then this is the place to show which cryptographic currency you think is going to win the race. Whether that's Bitcoin, Litecoin, Novacoin, Namecoin, Peercoin, Terracoin, Feathercoin, or Primecoin, go to theunionpodcast.com and donate using your favorite coin. Anytime one coin takes the lead, I will then, in that following episode, tell you who has taken the lead and by how much. This will be done, of course, on a one-for-one basis. Most of these cryptographic coins run on a decimal system, so it'll be easy to let you know who is in the lead and by how much on that same type of scale. Help the Union Podcast keep on growing and help point everyone in the direction of your favorite coin. Next week on the Union Podcast, we'll talk about CrossFit with a good friend of mine, Dawn.
Hi, I'm Dawn, and I'm here to talk about CrossFit, and I'm an expert on the subject, but I do have an opinion to share.
You have been listening to the Union Podcast. All rights are reserved by the content's creators.